everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to bring you the inside scoop on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can always find us at restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network. And, of course, you can download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm great.
And so I need to share with you something that I'm not sure that you know.
Oh, do share.
This show
is
actually our 7th year anniversary.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, we started in end of February, early March of 05 doing this show.
Oh, my God.
7 years of this.
Really? I had more hair when we started. No one knows that. It's radio.
But you had less of other things.
Yeah, that's true. What? I was going with that, but I don't know exactly what you're talking about.
Saddlebags.
That's exactly right. Okay, on to the mindless trivia with which we normally start our radio show.
7 years. Golly.
You know, there's a great publication online that it's a lovely magazine to read. I always make time for it. It's not a lot of in-depth, you know, 20-page articles. And it's also got an online version. It's called Plate.
Sure.
Plate Online is something
I'm not sure that it's not that that's a consumer magazine. That may be
might be industry.
Yeah, it might be only given to industry. But you know,
a lot of industry folks listen to our show.
Yeah, exactly.
But go to Plate Online. It's really got a lot of fun stuff. And they actually cool menu ideas. They're really on the mark with trends and some technology things that I've found in words of wisdom there. That I really like the magazine. I think it's well written. But they also have, like, the fun facts you get in your email so that you open it and read the magazine. And here are this week's fun facts from Plate Magazine. We'll just copy right on there. Usually when you see the words restaurant and employee and lawsuit together, it's the employee suing the restaurant. But Bar Veloce in New York is suing a former employee for defamation after the person started a leaflet campaign alleging wage violations, which it turns out were unfounded.
Wow. So the restaurant is
suing the employee for, you know.
You know, restaurants are in a kind of an unusual situation when it comes to this type of thing because, you know, publicity is such an important part of what we do. And there's getting your name out there and having there be positive connotations to your name. I mean,
sure.
I guess that's true of any company that sells anything. But having there be positive connotations out there, with the advent of the web and how that works now for restaurants, there's so much, I don't want to say image management because that sounds a little bit too...
No, I think it's fair. I think most people understand that's part of, you know, your...
But that there's so much of what you're doing
It's actually the term for it. It's called reputation management.
Right. But so much of what you're doing is guarding your image and protecting, you know, that part of what you do that I think when somebody comes in and does something to stain that image, in most cases, there is no recourse against the person who's writing something negative,
right,
writing something untrue, saying something untrue, because in the internet, everybody is just basically signing blind.
Right.
You know, our recourse on some of these websites, if somebody writes something that's untrue, you know, or defames us in any way, is to contact the website,
right,
and hopefully they'll pull the information.
And we had a situation where someone did that, and we contacted the website, and it came down. But in the week it took us to find it and get it down, you know, they said...
Right, you don't even know it's there.
And so somebody went and stayed at a hotel across the street, looked up that website, read this thing that was, you know, provably untrue and a violation of the terms of service of the website, so that's how we got it taken down. And they didn't come, you know?
Right.
And maybe, I don't know. But this is an instance where it's something different. You're alleging a fact. You're not saying I liked it, I hated it. Listen, everybody has a right to hate my restaurant.
But on a lot of the websites, we see it all the time. People allege facts that are simply untrue.
Yeah, I went to that restaurant, I got food poisoning. Yeah, I went back the next night, it happened again. I don't believe you. And then I saw a rat, and then a dog bit me on the way out. You know, there you go. But this is alleging wage violations. That's something that I would say if somebody did that, I would probably take action against
I'm sure that I would retaliate.
Well, because you know, that's alleging a criminal activity.
It's
yeah,
we,
I would go to the cops. Right.
You
know? No, horse heads would be killed in the... Anyway, okay, next one. Ready? Omaro Kantu, famous chef. You can check out some of his videos on contemporary food and avant-garde cuisine are pretty amazing. He had his laptop stolen from ING in Chicago, from Ing in Chicago, and he's got a lot of Twitter followers. He's got a lot of people that follow him. So Omaro is pretty well known, and he's been logging an online campaign because he has that tracker software, so that when your laptop is stolen, he can turn on the camera on his laptop and see where it is. So he's been spying on his laptop thief, trying to get it back.
I love it.
And because a lot of people follow Omaro, there are a lot of people who, this has become a thing. Everybody's trying to find Omaro Kantu's laptop, right?
Better than Where's Waldo?
Kantu has published some of the thief's web searches, which apparently include hot Latina booty, and has enlisted the help of his Facebook network to identify the man and decide to whether or not to bust him for possession of stolen property and to find him, and as well to censure him for some serious lifestyle faux pas.
Please know that that's exactly what I would do.
Our buddy Gordon Ramsay, also in the news. He went to a show at Brixton Prison to sort of teach inmates how to cook, and they were very receptive to the whole thing, until his crew, you know, whenever you go into a prison, you count up everything when you go in, and you count up everything when you go out. Lost a potato peeler.
Oh, golly.
The entire prison was on lockdown for 2 hours.
Oh, golly, did they find the peeler?
Then in the end, after 2 hours, they realized they had miscounted on the way in.
Oh, my goodness.
Hold on.
Okay, here's where I do the, you miscounted on the way in, really? That's
your
answer?
Yeah,
that's your answer, really? You miscounted on the way in?
Yeah, someone's going to get shanked with a vegetable peeler. Or they'll peel them very slowly.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
Yeah, I don't think Gordon's so popular with the inmates now.
You've been watching too much Hannibal Lecter.
And then Heston Blumenthal, interesting, he is the one, we talked about this 5 years ago, where they were trying to grow cultured meat, right? No animal, just grow the meat. And you basically, I remember the technological problem was they were able to...
No exercise.
Right, they were able to grow the cells of a muscle in a test tube. But it was crappy because there's no exercise to condition the muscle. And they were working on, at the time, using electrical impulses to exercise the muscle they were growing in a petri dish. Doesn't this sound delicious? Doesn't this make you want to go out and go... Anyway, Heston Blumenthal... as a proof of concept for in vitro meat, a Dutch stem cell scientist will grow a hamburger from beef muscle and fat stem cells. And it will cost about €250,000 to produce this burger. And it's a proof of concept. And frankly, it's a concept I think better left unproven.
I hate it.
Yeah, I hate it. I totally hate it. You get further from, I don't know. I don't know, man.
I hate it.
You know what? It raises
everything about it.
It raises a lot of interesting quandaries, though.
Could a vegetarian
or a vegan even then? You know, there's no central nervous system. Is there a soul? Is there a conscious? There's no consciousness. I mean, I would assume. You know, is it endowed with spirits, with Buddhist spirits? I mean, what's the view of grown?
We need to get a vegan on to find out.
I don't think they know. I think they're going to need to figure it out. I think Omaro's going to help us, make this burger. The only thing that we can be sure about with cultured meat is I don't want any. Okay?
The other thing we can be sure about is, don't we have a better way to spend $250,000?
€250,000 even.
I'm sorry, $400,000.
You know, I don't know, but does this, you know, maybe create a source of protein inexpensively in the long run for the world? You know, it'll help us on our mission to Mars, of course. We've got to keep those astronauts. I don't know. I don't want any part of it. All right, let's come back and talk about some more real things.
We'll be back
in just a moment. You're with the Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. And our guest today is Charles Neal. We've known Charles for many years as an importer, and in the restaurant business, we've purchased his wonderful artisanal products, specifically his spirits. And he's written a new book. It is a comprehensive tome, and it is the best book I've ever seen on the topic. The book is called Calvados, The Spirit of Normandy.
Charles, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me.
The book is... I geeked out on it, as I mentioned before the show, as we got you on the line. I geeked out on it last night. It's about 800 pages of full-color, textbook-sized, looks like a school book, except more beautiful, on everything about Calvados. Has anyone ever written such a comprehensive thing?
It's a school book about Calvados.
Yeah,
you know. It's great.
School book. Imagine if we could go to school and learn about things like Calvados and single malt whiskey and wine instead of, you know, calculus and physics.
I'd have been a much better student.
Charles, this is the school I've chosen.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have cut school, would we?
No, not at all. So about Calvados, well, I mean, has there been such a work preceding yours?
No, there hasn't. I mean, there have been a number of books written about Calvados. I think there's been one other book written in English and a couple of books in French. But like most books, they tend to be somewhat generalized and don't necessarily speak much about the producers themselves, or, you know, they kind of rehash information that we already know that we could go onto a website or something like that and kind of get. But what I wanted to do with this book was really to go to the producers themselves and to kind of write about Calvados from the inside out, to include lots of information about the production and things like that, but also to speak a lot with the actual producers and get their take on what Calvados is and how they produce it.
It's almost like two books. You wrote one book that is the most exhaustive, comprehensive book about what Calvados is out there and technically what it is, and the land and the distilling process and the fruit that sits at the base of it, which I want to talk about separately. And then half the book is in-depth profiles of, did you get every producer?
Yeah.
Did you get every producer in Calvados?
Yeah, you know, the genesis of the book in a way was I wanted, after writing a book about Armagnac, which came out at the end of the 90s, I decided to write about another region of France. And Armagnac is a region that my wife is from and that I go to very, very frequently and I will say that I know very well. And I wanted to write about something else in France. And Normandy was an area that I had started to bring in some Calvados from, and I was going to Normandy and found that the accent was different, the foods that people were eating were different, the climate was different. It was a totally different region of France for me, which was of interest. And so I also got a list from the Governing Bureau of Calvados and found that there were only about 25 producers of Calvados. So I thought, wow, I could go there for a couple of weeks or something like that and see every producer and write, you know, a really good book about Calvados. Well, I started doing that, and then I started seeing other lists that show that there were 40 producers, and then there were 60 producers, and then there were 80 producers, and the list kept growing and growing. And in a way, I had set out the book to see every single producer that existed in the region that actually sold their Calvados, because there's a lot of people that make Calvados.
Right, sure, they're just growing apples and making Calvados.
Exactly. So it was just one of these things that every year I found that there were 10 more producers that I almost felt the need to go and see, even though, you know, their total sales for a year may have been 30 or 40 bottles of Calvados.
That's the most amazing thing about Calvados that I've always loved about Calvados. Number one is back in the day when, you know, cognac couldn't be a vintage cognac. You had vintage Armagnac, and you could have vintage Calvados from a certain year. And you would find these small producers. I mean, it was to be a young wine buyers like Mark and I were in our late 20s, to find little producers of Calvados was tremendous, and you would get it, and their total production was, you know, measured in the dozens of cases, maybe, or less.
And it's always one of those things, I suppose it's like, you know, being in a small restaurant in Italy in some obscure region and drinking a wine in that whole setting that you're in, and the wine tastes great, and all of a sudden, you know, you come back to the United States and you find out what the wine was actually that you were actually drinking was something that was not all that good, but in the setting it certainly tasted good. And I think that's certainly the case with a lot of these very, very small producers, that perhaps if you took the Calvados out of its setting and put it up in a somewhat sterile tasting room against a bunch of other Calvados, you might not think very much of it. But amongst the apple trees and the smells of the orchard and things like that, all of a sudden it's a beautiful thing.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the parts of the book that you talk about that I found really intriguing was you talk about Normandy and even a little bit about Brittany in the book. You know, as a young man, I was able to do a tour of Normandy and Brittany and stayed at Mont Saint-Michel, and you included that in the book. You included that whole you kind of painted the scene before you started to talk about the producers, of the history of the region, you know, why it's been producing for so long, and what a beautiful and picturesque kind of place it is, and, you know, although it hasn't always been for for instance, World War II.
Sure.
So talk to us about, Charles, talk to us about the region, and for those of in the audience who don't know, Calvados is an apple brandy, and the best place to get Calvados in the world is the Normandy region of France. Why Calvados and cider in Normandy and not wine and brandy like everywhere and grape brandy like everywhere else?
Well, to respond to Mark's comment, I mean, I think that's one of these things. You know, I don't necessarily read all that much of the wine press. And one of the reasons is because it just seems to be magazines that have, you know, note after tasting note. You know, they have a region, but it's all in black and white, and they don't really speak much about what the food of the region is, what the people are like, what the customs of the area are. And I suppose that I wanted to kind of lay out for people before they actually got into reading about the subject of Calvados, the area itself and how those people differ from other people in France. I mean, a lot of times we sort of say, oh, he's French or he's American, but obviously somebody that's living on an Indian reservation in New Mexico has a very different life than somebody that lives in a suburb outside of Boston, yet we're both Americans. And so I wanted to really kind of magnify, I suppose, some of those differences between people and customs in that region of France as to other places in France, and kind of lay that out before people actually started reading about one of their most famous productions.
So give us an example of something that is customarily different in Normandy, how the Norman people differ either in their customs or certainly their food and their spirits, but you know, how you convey the cultural differences of Normandy as a distinct region in the book.
Well, you know, I would say that it's northern France, so they're perhaps a little bit less rustic than perhaps some other regions of France, southwestern France, as an example, which tends to be a little bit less explored, a little bit less visited by people from the outside world. Obviously, in Normandy, it's very close to Britain, and there's a lot of people that come up from Paris as well to spend time on the beaches or at some of the casino spots up on the northern coast. So I think just the accessibility of people and their being accustomed to seeing people from elsewhere, and their ability to perhaps communicate with those people on a more easy level is something that you find in Normandy. Obviously, the fact that it's on the sea, seafood, fish, you know, has almost equal importance to meat, which isn't necessarily the case in other parts of France. The cow culture, I mean, Normandy is one of these areas that, along with Brittany and some parts of the Loire, are the biggest milk producers in France. So the whole cream, butter, and obviously the big three cheeses, Camembert and Livarot, as well as Pont l'Evêque, all kind of cow milk cheeses are very, very important for people's meals and the livelihood of the region.
Well, and I mean, culturally it is very different, and it's interesting a place to go visit. But when you get there, you'll see that in the food is reflected the difference food as far as the dairy being very important up there. But you also see apples everywhere, and it's not a great place to grow grapes. I mean, that's one of the reasons that you grow apples there. It is a great place for apples. Is that just more history or more climate?
I think climate. I think it's both too damp as well as a little bit too cold to grow grapes. There is one producer that's growing some grapes up there, and they're mostly varietals like Müller-Thurgau or Pinot Gris, things like that, things that you might find in, like, Luxembourg.
Cold-weather grapes.
Cold-weather grapes, right. But that's you know, very kind of oddball type of producer. But it's just the fact that both the soils, which can be you know, very deep with some good humidity in the soil, are just very, very good for apple trees. And the further south you go into an area called the Domfronte, which is where La Mortone is from, then you really get a big presence of pear. Because we really should say that rather than Calvados being an apple brandy, Calvados is a cider-based brandy in which the cider can be made with both apples or pears.
And in some cases, more pears than apples. I mean,
and in some cases, like La Mortone, who was a producer that you mentioned before, is using 70 or 80% pears in their Calvados.
You know, not to be a commercial, but we have something called the Spirits Project we do here at the cocktail bar at Catherine Lombardi. And every Thursday night at 6:30, we open a spirit, a different kind of crazy, unusual bottle. And we pour it for the first 24 people come. They get an ounce of it at cost. And it's a way to open up the dialogue about spirits and all. And Thursday night, we're actually opening a 78 Le Morton Calvados.
Great.
Yeah.
It's gonna that's cool for your customers, that's for sure.
Gonna be a cool thing. Now, and just for those of you who are geeking out there, let's go. I wanna sort of give you the basics of where, you know, what spirits come from. From grains, we get beer. From beer, we distill it, and we get spirit. We get whiskey. From fruit, we get wine of some sort, and wine from tree fruits is called cider. And so from wine, we get brandy, and Calvados is a type of brandy. So it goes, you know, tree fruit becomes cider becomes Calvados, whereas grapes become wine, grape wine that then becomes brandy. I know I just geeked everyone out there. Is anyone still listening? Is anyone still listening? Have you not turned it off? But did I get that right, Charles?
I would say that's I've never put it that way, but I guess that's right. Apart from the fact that from tree fruit, you know, in many, many areas of France, like let's say people that are growing plums or apricots, you know, might also distill those, but leave it as a clear spirit rather than put it into oak. And so then I would refer to it as being more eau de vie.
Yeah,
I normally call eau de vie something that comes out of the still that's clear, hasn't seen oak, and once it goes into the oak and starts obtaining color, then it becomes brandy.
Yeah, and the oak is an important part of Calvados. Let's talk about that for just a minute.
Yes, actually, you know, oak is one of those things that in Armagnac and in Cognac, there's a tradition of using new oak to age spirits, which obviously gives them a lot of what I might call nutrients for the spirit, like vanillas and spice and some of those kind of caramel.
Everything nice? The earth and spice and everything.
Sugar, caramel, spice, and everything nice. Exactly.
I haven't fired you in weeks. You're fired again.
Thank you. Yeah. My life has been changed.
He fired me.
I'm firing Francis.
Right. It's going to be the restaurant guy starting tomorrow. Yeah.
There you go. But with Calvados, traditionally people just put it into very old casks. And so it's very common to go into somebody's cellar and see casks that are totally stained black by time. I mean, you really don't see any presence of new oak. Or even if they say, oh, yeah, I used some new oak, and then you go look in their cave, they've got, you know, a barrel that's kind of black that's probably 10 years old, and that's what they're referring to as being new oak.
Well, tell people what new oak does as opposed to the old oak that they use in Calvados. How does that affect the spirit?
Well, what happens is when you put a clear spirit into new oak, you've got the toast from the barrel, which is going to secrete a lot of things into the spirit, and those might be some vanillin from the oak, so kind of vanilla type of flavor that will arrive, like we get with wine. Also some spice, so maybe some cinnamon or clove or pepper type of notes that will come out of the barrel. And then you also get this, you know, sugared type of note, which is kind of a caramel type of flavor. And as things age, it becomes a little bit more of a buttered toffee type of note. And caramel is always one of those words with spirits that's, you know, difficult to say because everybody is under the impression that caramel is simply something that you add to a spirit to artificially give it the impression of age or some sweetness or something like that. But caramel and toffee are notes that actually do come from natural aging in a wood barrel.
Well, I think that's what those people who are adding
adding caramel
in.
Color.
If you're adding caramel color, you're trying to trick people into thinking that you've added real caramel into, you know,
you've imparted caramel
naturally.
Right. Yes. I mean, basically, you're just speeding up as something like wood chips or tea bags, you know, that people might put into wine barrels nowadays, give the impression that something was aged in a new oak barrel, which was costly, and the fact is it wasn't. So, but what a lot of people in Normandy will do in order to, because once if you have a barrel that's 10 years old or 15 years old that really is spent and doesn't have any of those things within the wood to give. What some people will do is either refurbish the inside of the barrel, so kind of scrape it down so that you hit a new layer of oak that might give some of those flavors, or the more traditional thing, I suppose, that most kind of peasant farmers might do is to simply put cider into the barrel for perhaps 4 or 5 months, and the tannin from the cider will kind of sink into the wood a little bit. And then they'll take the cider out, put Calvados back in the barrel, and then some of that tannin will seep into the Calvados and give it some color. But traditionally as well, I mean, I would say probably half of the Calvados that I tasted in Normandy or that I saw is very, very light in color, almost like, you know, a kind of golden, I don't want to say urine samples, but I just said it.
Yeah, you did, unfortunately, right on the radio. That's preserved forever on the internet eventually, but people get what you mean. You know, we're forgiving. You're an eccentric fellow with an amazing book. Hey, listen, we're going to take a quick break, but I want to come back on the other side, and I'd like to talk a little bit about the history of Normandy, some of the other cool stuff that is related to Calvados and brandy that you can get in Normandy, and a little bit more about your wonderful book in just a moment. We're talking with Charles Neal. His book is Calvados, The Spirit of Normandy, and we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and on restaurantguysradio.com. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys Radio Show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to restaurantguysradio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, and we're having a fascinating conversation with Charles Neal. Charles is a great importer of spirits, and specifically Calvados among the many spirits he imports. And if you're just joining us, his new book, Calvados, The Spirit of Normandy, is amazing. We've talked about the production of Calvados and how it maybe differs from other brandies. I'd like to know a little bit more, share with the readers a little bit more about the history of apples in Normandy and of Calvados in Normandy. I mean, one of the things that's really amazing when I traveled in France as a young man, because there wasn't that much Calvados in the United States back then, was you found all of these old Calvados, you know, that would be everywhere. And I found them to be delicious, and I found each bottle to be interesting and not in a single style. How long has apple production been prominent in Normandy, and how long is how far back does Calvados go in the history of Normandy?
Well, there are records of ciders being distilled in Normandy that go back to the 1500s. And what people think is that somehow some pilgrims, perhaps from northern Spain, which also has a big apple culture, came up the coast of France to Normandy and brought with them certain cuttings or grafts of various trees, and then began cultivating them in Normandy, which had a climate being along the English Channel, which is very, very perfect, really, for growing apple trees, in that it's humid, the soils are clay, there's some stone in the soil, too, to give some support and some heat to the roots of trees. And so little by little, apples became something that were grown all over Normandy, and people at this point in time were allowed to distill a certain amount per year without being taxed for their distillation, and people needed something to drink. And so if you were in certain other regions of France, you grew some grapes, and people weren't necessarily marketing their products. I mean, it's amazing to me sometimes when I just think about the wine world even. I mean, supermarkets didn't appear really in France until the 1960s and even the beginning of the 1970s. And I think the first person to bottle their wine and sell it with their own label on the bottle in, let's say, a place like Matteron in southwestern France was around the early 1970s. So basically people that had vineyards or that had orchards were perhaps selling some apples to big cooperatives or big industrial producers that would then take care of everything else. But they were always saving a certain portion of their production and making cider with it, and that would basically be their beverage for the year. So rather than drinking wine on a table in Normandy, everybody drank cider. If you went to a cafe, you didn't get a glass of wine, you got a glass of cider or a pitcher of cider. I mean, there were certain people that would drink 8 liters of cider a day. You know, that might be cut with some water or something like that. But cider itself is only about 4 or 5% alcohol. So you can pretty much, one of the beauties of cider is that you can drink a bottle of cider at brunch and not necessarily feel, you know, like you're under the table or can't really function later on in the afternoon. So I think that everybody was making cider, and then basically whatever was left over at the end of the year, they would distill, and they would then have, you know, that in their house for the year, and they might use it for a number of different things. They might use it to simply drink, but they might also use it in cooking. They might use it to flambé things. They might use it for toothaches for children. They might use it to help a cow recover after they'd given birth, to ease its pain perhaps a little bit by putting some on the hay and having them eat that. There were a lot of reasons for having Calvinists, for having some strong liquor around. And I think little by little, as the 60s came, the 70s came, there was a lot of alcoholism in the region, and they decided, the government decided that they wanted to cut down a little bit on people's production. And of course, alcohol is something that the government can collect money on as far as tax money, and so there started to be a lot of crackdown on clandestine distillation, or distillation that people, the government didn't know about, and things began becoming more regulated. People began moving to the cities. There was an exodus from the countryside to the cities, which is still happening today, and people want land rather than the apple orchard. And so little by little, there's a lot of apple trees that, or pear trees that are disappearing from the region. And especially when you have apple trees which are grown on what's called standard rootstock, which is a tall apple tree that's about 25 or 30 feet tall, they take about 18 to 20 years before they even start giving much usable fruit. So it really is a long-term investment for some of the real traditional producers.
And it's also a tremendous tragedy when you lose a tree like that. You know, I mean, that's...
It is, but it's amazing the resilience that some of the producers have, because a lot of producers, they might have 4,000 trees on their property. I don't want to say a lot of producers, but some might have 4,000 trees. And there's been storms that have taken out 400 trees, for instance, of their trees. And it's amazing because I'm always like, damn, 400 trees, you know, that's going to take you forever to, like, replant these. And they're just sort of like, yeah, well, you know, it happens.
It's part of the cycle.
It's not the first time. It's not the last time. I mean, every year people tend to replant a little bit. So it's just in those years they're going to have to replant a little bit more. But they still have, you know, 3,600 trees.
We have to talk about a tiny little fact that I thought was fascinating. One tiny little spot in your book where you talk about grafting. Mm-hmm. Where, now, if you plant an apple seed, it won't necessarily grow that type of apple. It may grow a different type of apple. So,
correct.
So grafting is done, and so you can guarantee what type of apples you're going to get?
Yes.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, what will happen is that there's a number of different apples that are used to make both cider and Calvados. And it's really impossible to talk about Calvados, I suppose, without talking about cider, because cider is the base product that you're using. And I think that there's acidic apples, there's sweet apples, there's bittersweet apples, and there's bitter apples. And all of those together, I mean, it's almost like, you know, if you were making Bordeaux wine or if you're making something from the Rhone, it's trying to get the right balance between something that's acidic and something that's sweet. And generally people tend to favor bittersweet apples.
Well, I have a friend who's got an apple orchard locally here in New Jersey, and one of the things she says is the worst thing you can do to make cider is use only one type of apple.
Right. And that's perhaps, you know, one of the, I mean, you know, perhaps someday in America people will make really, really good cider and really, really good apple brandy. But at this point in time, I think there hasn't been a lot of study as far as what varieties to use, or trying to get this, you know, 20 or 30 different varieties in your cider to make the most complex and balanced cider that you possibly can. People are basically finding an apple orchard that maybe has two or three different types of apples and just using those and then thinking that that's going to turn out something good. But it's almost like, I don't know, planting certain grapes on Long Island that are completely that basically have no potential to do well in that area, but the grapes are trendy in the world, and so people think that at least people will buy the variety when the name is on the label.
Let's talk a little bit more about the fruit, because I found a couple of things fascinating about the production of Calvados that even if you know about spirits overall, you know, Calvados is unique. I think among wood-aged brandies in the world. In Calvados, the fruit speaks more than in any other brandy. I mean, you taste apples in Calvados. You taste different, whether it's the baked apple of an old Calvados or a Camus, who's one of your producers, or it's the bright, fresh, crisp apple of a young Calvados. And so there are tree fruits, number one, and I read in your book something I really was unaware of, is that the way that the apples are harvested is they're harvested when they fall. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there are, in Calvados, there's two types of producers. People are divided into two types. It's either an industrial producer, which are the kind of big negociant houses or cooperatives, and then you've got the small agricultural producer. And when people aren't necessarily caring that much about the quality of the apples because they're going to be selling it to a larger house that isn't all that... It doesn't really place that much emphasis on the quality, let's say, of the apple.
They're looking for the weight of the apple.
They're looking
the
for the weight of the apple. They might use a particular machine that they hook up to the back of their tractor, which vibrates the tree, and the apples will fall. But generally, people will say apples fall from the tree when the weight of the apple becomes so heavy that its stem can't hold it on the tree, and at that point, the apple is mature and ripe. And so most producers will simply wait until the apples fall from the tree. And these are the kind of planting of an orchard is quite complex as well. We started talking about grafting before, but to get back to that point, you're taking a certain variety of apple that you want, and you're basically cutting into the stem of a tree and then placing that part of the tree into that stem, kind of sealing it off with a type of tape or wax, and then that variety will grow on top of that rootstock. So you can basically say, okay, I want Bine Rouge in this part of my orchard and plant or graft a lot of Bine Rouge trees that you might either have from your own grafts or buy them at a nursery and control what trees you then have in your orchard. But what you're also doing is looking for pollination is something that's very important because these trees pollinate at different times of the year, so you want to have certain varieties that are going to bloom at the same time so that pollination can take place between them. And plus, most of these producers are very, very small, so you don't want all your fruit dropping at the same time. And so there's certain trees that tend to drop their fruit at the end of September, others in October, others in November, others as far as late as December. And so what you're really trying to do is to have this balance throughout your orchard, to have varieties that bloom at different times, to have varieties that drop their fruit at different times, to have different varieties themselves in between these acidic, bitter, bittersweet, and sweet apples. And that creates this kind of huge diversity within your orchard normally. So there's not many producers out there that I would say have less than 15 varieties of apples, and most producers have 40 or 50 different types of apples in their orchard.
And one of the reasons you don't want all your fruit to drop at once is because as a small farmer, the harvest is the most labor-intensive thing a farmer does, and if it all drops at the same time, you wouldn't have the capacity to, you know, pull in the fruit from every
tree.
Sure,
it would literally rot on the ground while you
absolutely,
while you're trying to get
there. Absolutely.
And so what's fascinating, though, I just want to comment on the wait for the apples to fall, you know, and wine growers, and we've talked with many wine growers on the show and visited many wine regions, you know, one of the big decisions that the winemaker makes is when to harvest the grapes exactly. You know, is it physiologically ripe? Is it, you know, is there enough sugar in it? And, you know, there are a number of different methods that they'll use to sort of judge in their judgment when it's time to harvest the grapes. The apples tell you when they're ready, huh?
Basically, they do. You know, in some cases, because many, many Calvados producers also have cows. As we mentioned before, there's a lot of cheese and things that come from cow's milk. And so a lot of the apples that have, shall we call, viruses or little problems within that drop at an earlier time, normally the cows are within the orchard until about August or so, and the cows will eat those apples. So in a way, that's the first kind of pass through the vineyard, if we compare it with wine, is the cows going through and eating the kind of bad apples that fall. And then at a certain point in time, they're taken out of the orchard.
I was going to say, then you get the cows out of there.
then you get the cows out of there because it makes harvesting a lot less smelly and you don't have to wash your clothes as much. Urine samples, you know, excrement.
Yeah, this is great.
Great show. Thanks. That's great.
I can see why you're not in marketing, Charles. Charles,
so just to go back to the grafting question again. So might you have two different types of apples on the same tree?
Not there. You can do that. I mean, you know, people in their backyards, for instance, I think can have three or four different types of apples within the same tree. But there, it's not. People don't do that. No.
I'm growing an apple tree.
I look at your eyes and I thought, how can I have apples from Mark's tree next year?
No, you can do that in your backyard. You can graft, you know, I think maybe four or maybe even five different types of apples onto a tree, but in Normandy, at least, you know, for people that are producing cider and Calvados, it's really just one variety. They generally have a certain rootstock. You're looking for a rootstock that, you know, grows straight, basically, and is somewhat resistant to various things, and then you're grafting on top of that.
And when you're talking about traditional trees, if you visit a lot of places that grow apples for fruit today in the United States, you will find the apple trees grafted onto special rootstock that makes it grow very low to the ground, so it's easier to pick the apples. And that's not what they're doing on the agricultural farms in Calvados.
I'd say there are a lot of people because there's what I was calling standard rootstock before, which is the kind of tall tree. There's also dwarf rootstock, which is commonly used nowadays because the beauty of dwarf rootstock, shall I say, is that it starts giving fruit in 3 or 4 years as opposed to, you know, 18, 19, 20 years down the road. So people, if they have a small farm and they're just starting out their production and they don't have the benefit of having former generations who had planted orchards that have been maintained over the years, really their choice, if they want to get into the cider business in their lifetime, is to plant trees on dwarf rootstock. And so dwarf trees, you know, they're probably grow to about 10 feet tall. And some of them you can even, you know, trellis as you might grapes or something like that. But it's a little bit more of what one might call an industrial type of production. I mean, you eliminate cows from the orchard, so you don't have that. Some people will introduce sheep into the orchard to nourish the land a little bit. But there are a lot of producers that have this type of dwarf rootstock, which is called bastige in Normandy, and who are defenders of it. And obviously the production is much more, too, because you can jam 500 or 600 trees into a hectare as opposed to 100 trees, which go into a hectare of standard rootstock trees.
So let's go past the tree for a second. Is there a special way that cider is pressed that's different from grapes that are pressed to make...
Yeah, because basically with grapes, there's a lot of juice which will come out of the grape itself. But with apples, you've got, you know, kind of a texture inside the apple that juice doesn't automatically fall from. So what you need to do is you need to crush the apple first, and then you need to press what's crushed, and the juice kind of spills out the side of the press. So just the... You know, in a way, you're getting juice out of the fruit itself, but the juice comes out of a grape much easier than it does out of an apple. So it's basically the pressing method which is going to be different. But some producers are using, you know, wine bladder presses and things like that. But the important thing is that the apples have to go into kind of like a chipper, I suppose, is the best way to describe it, a grinder, which basically grinds them into a pulp. People will normally leave that pulp for maybe 4 to 6 hours so that the apples actually oxidize a little bit because they feel that they're going to get more color from the cider as well as more aromas. So there's a, you know, one of these differences between wine, the wine world and the cider world is in the wine world we're always attempting to prevent oxidation, whereas in this case they're almost promoting oxidation a little bit in order to get more color and flavor.
Well, Charles, I congratulate you on the book, and I've loved our conversation about cider, and I love and Calvados, and I love drinking yours in particular.
Charles, I have to say, I got presented with the, hey, we're going to do a show on Calvados, and I was like, a whole show on Calvados?
How are we going to make that work?
How are we going to do that? Then I got your book, Then I started reading your book.
And we're at a time. Thought, and we're at a time with five more questions.
Wow, exactly. Yeah, and we're out of time,
we
and we're not
two
done.
Shows on it now, right?
Yeah. Well, let's not push it with the audience. Okay. Let's see how the first one goes. if you would like to find out about Calvados, and if you drink spirits and you don't drink Calvados, you're really missing out. And if you would like to go into the Calvados world, it's one of those areas where there are still a lot of small producers. There's a lot to be learned. The variety among producers and styles and ages is amazing. And our roadmap for this journey, an excellent roadmap for this journey, is Calvados, The Spirit of Normandy by our guest, Charles Neal. And Charles, thanks for coming on the show. It's been lovely, Charles, to have you.
Hey, thank you guys. Drink Calvados and stay young.
I think that's also not so good at writing mottos. Okay, well, we'll have that down. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys on the Heritage Radio Network and restaurantguysradio.com. Hey there, everybody. Welcome back. It's The Restaurant Guys. Calvados, you know, Mark, that Calvados has been, for me, since we got into spirits, I was always fascinated.
About a year ago, you and I had a conversation, and I think we decided together at the same time that Calvados probably offers the best bang for your buck in brandy in the world. Period.
I agree. Everything from young to old.
I mean, you can buy a 35-year-old Calvados for $100, $150,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, and have a bottle of it and drink it 25 times.
Yeah, and Calvados, even the industrial producers of Calvados make a pretty good product, mm-hmm. But you know, there is a reason why there are a lot of small producers, and
right.
Charles Neal is one way to go, but there are some other importers as well. And I just like that variety. It's, you know, most of cognac anyway is dominated by large houses, though there are some small cognacs.
It is also, and we really didn't talk about this, but it's a really cool place to visit. As a young man, my father stayed in that area during World War II, after the Americans attacked and that whole bit. And
landed on the beaches at Normandy.
No, he was not. Well, the Americans landed on the beaches.
D-Day.
Yeah, he was a little farther south. But we went on kind of an excursion to all the different places he lived in and kind of drove through Normandy and then through Brittany. Really, it's a beautiful area of the country. And I will tell you, Mont-Saint-Michel, which is a little... I guess you'd call it an island because off the coast of right by where Normandy and Brittany come together, maybe one of the most beautiful places on earth, and so interesting because what happens is the when the tide comes in, Mont-Saint-Michel is on a road that connects to Normandy. When the tide comes in, the road is gone, and there is and Mont-Saint-Michel becomes an island 12 hours a day.
Wow.
And then the tide goes out, and Mont-Saint-Michel is accessible again by road. And it's beautiful, beautiful church right in it's very small and beautiful church right in kind of the center of the little island at the top of it. It's just a really pretty and picturesque place to be, and, you know, lots of history. And it's cool because you can't walk out of Mont-Saint-Michel. You have to stay on the road because it's surrounded by quicksand. So it's just one of the coolest places on earth.
That's really phenomenal. Yeah, and you can sit in a cafe and drink some excellent cider.
Exactly. And you can sit in a cafe and drink some excellent
cider.
And
if you miss the tide and you get stuck there overnight, start drinking Calvados. You'll be fine.
Yeah, got to spend a night there. It was really, really
awesome.
Unbelievable.
Hey, we need one shout-out before we go. There is one American apple brandy that is worthy of note, and that is made by our friend Lisa Laird. And her company is right here in Jersey in Scobieville. Laird Applejack, and even better than that, Laird Bottled and Bond Apple Brandy. I don't sit around sipping them, but as a cocktail ingredient, they're indispensable.
It is a great ingredient, and every cocktail bar in America is using it.
And you can't play the song of the American cocktail book without that instrument, you know. And Calvados does not substitute for Applejack. In a cocktail. But, you know, the other thing that they should mention in Charles Neal's book, and you should go to restaurantguysradio.com if you want to find out more about the book. There's a section in there. This is what I respect about a spirits guy. He has the sipping stuff, but he also has a cocktail section. And there are some historical Calvados cocktails. Pretty wild stuff. Hey, listen, I hope you guys have all enjoyed the hour as much as we have. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys at restaurantguysradio.com and the Heritage Radio Network.